Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
So I was wondering if I could ask you to play along with something. We have some fairly, I would say, vague, but you know, rather conventional titles in our industry, in radio and in audio. Things like associate producer. I don't mean that to disrespect any of our associate producers. It's just that, like, wouldn't you guys like a little spice? I'm just going to interrupt myself here for a second to say that I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and I'm talking to Bridget Quigg. Bridget's a veteran writer and marketer for various tech companies who developed a one-woman comedy show spoofing the tech world. And she played with us this sort of bingo game where she spices up job titles inspired by some of the doozies that they throw around at tech startups. Okay, back to the conversation. So I thought we'd ask Dr. Bridget to see if she could doctor up a little bit of a more grandiose title.
Gabriel, I'm glad you asked. I did some thinking about this, earlier, and I was thinking of, like, you know, Chief Commander of Audio Initiatives.
Oh.
Maybe.
Yes.
Chief Maker of News Audiation. Is that even a thing? I don't even know.
It is now. Aaron Hennessy, you listening? Okay. To help you out, I thought I'd throw in a few synonyms that you can pick from here. Here's
a little list. Okay.
I don't know if that might help spark some ideas.
Oh, my gosh. It's excellent. Okay, so we're going to go with, lead minister for ear candy strategy.
Yes.
Ear candy, you win with that. That's brilliant. So supreme craftsman for sonic wave management.
Very nice. Kevin, right. You listening?
Okay.
This is, I could probably do this all day.
I think we have a board game in the making, maybe.
So to get half serious for a second, this phenomenon seems to gesture at something real, right? I mean, it gets a little bit at what makes startup culture so simultaneously thrilling and ridiculous,
mm-hmm.
right? So let's start with the thrilling part. Like, what about this you think gets at what makes it really fun to work for one of these companies?
It's very true. When you enter into a startup, you don't just do one job, pretty much ever. You usually have to pick up and take on projects, learn new skills all the time. And this getting a great job title kind of goes with that energy of you're going to do so much more and be so much more than you would at a large company where you are cogging the wheel. You have to get 10 approvals for everything you write. At a startup, sometimes like, hey, we gotta fire up the homepage. Just come up with something, and like, we need it today because we're meeting with somebody tomorrow. So everything you do has to kind of be big and amazing because you're trying to get money.
Trying to get money. You know, we can relate to that here at KNKX. This is a place where everybody does everything, where people believe in the organization, where on a good day you can hear the energy and enterprise and fun in the programming. And yes, we are also trying to get money. This is our fall fund drive right now, and we're asking for your support to help keep this startup going. Our theme today is Money Talks, some of our favorite stories about how money, or the lack of it, can drive the choices we make. And when you make the choice to donate, you can do it at knkx.org. And in the meantime, on with the show. So, money talks, and money can also fly and disappear. More than 40 years ago, a guy known as D.B. Cooper hijacked an airplane and disappeared with a big bag of cash. The case remains unsolved. KNKX's Ed Runko brought us a fresh take on the legend.
D.B. Cooper hijacked a plane in Portland, let the passengers off here in Seattle, collected a ransom, and then he took off again. But when the plane landed in Reno, he wasn't on it. And they say that he opened the back stairs of the plane and bailed out with the ransom money and a parachute. Never to be seen again.
Dropped right into legend.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was 1971, November of 1971. I was not born yet. Were you alive?
I was not. So I got in touch with somebody who was and who has close knowledge of this case.
This is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Anchorman, Anchor Myth, Anchor Legend, Bill Curtis.
Bill Curtis?
Bill Curtis.
Oh, man, the scorekeeper and judge for NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's like the guy you hear from it, the Anchorman movies. This is one iconic voice.
Yeah, yeah. But earlier in his career, he was a reporter. And I talked to him about his time covering this case as it unfolded.
36 passengers got off the jetliner in Seattle last night, left aboard four crew members and the hijacker dressed in a business suit.
I was a news correspondent for CBS News, working out of the L.A. Bureau in 1970 to 73. I covered the Manson case and Angela Davis and big headlined primarily legal cases.
And carrying a plain briefcase, which he told the crew held explosives. With the full ransom collected from Seattle banks and four parachutes aboard, the plane headed for Reno.
It took Our stories were ranged from environmental to fights at Oakland and the recruiting station and People's Park. It was a great time. Great time. Riots. Love it.
Now, Gabe, this was also a time when there were a lot of hijackings in the commercial aviation industry. But Curtis says that the D.B. Cooper case, it was special.
It had this nature of James Bond. You know, he was dressed in a suit. He was described as very nice, about 5'10 to 6 feet, brown hair, wore sunglasses at night. And he ordered four parachutes along with his ransom money. And everybody kind of got the idea, well, maybe this guy's going to try and jump.
So as far as we know, that's what he did, right?
727s, Gabe, had a staircase that dropped out of the back of the plane's fuselage. And when this plane landed in Reno, the staircase was hanging open and was like completely shredded, too. And so the crew talks to the FBI and then hears something that would never happen today. The crew goes out and faces reporters. Now, they don't say much, but they're still in front of the press.
We just don't want to discuss it any further.
Have you been told by the FBI not to discuss?
No, they handle their investigation, and my company would rather have it released through them.
But I was really surprised that you had access to the crew right after they were debriefed by the FBI.
It's a different time. And if you stop and think, the media then were three network, half-hour evening news, no 24-hour cable, no cable in those days. So you didn't have a CNN. So the competition looked like a lot, but at the time it was nothing. I covered the Manson case, and we had 12 reporters, most of whom got a seat in the courtroom for 10 months if they wanted it that long. For the O.J. Simpson, there were 3,000.
Yeah, can you just imagine if like Reddit existed when D.B. Cooper happened? I mean, it would have been a totally different story. So, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of hijackings around this time. It was sort of something that just made news periodically. But how big of a deal was this case?
It was a huge deal. There had been plenty of these before. One guy went all the way from Los Angeles to Italy in 1969. D.B. Cooper's case 2 years later, though, was the first time that someone had bailed from a jet, but not the last.
There was a guy named McCoy who was from Provo, Utah.
Richard McCoy was his name, and he hijacked a United Airlines flight during a stop in Denver. And this was about 5 months after D.B. Cooper did his thing.
For a while, we were running on every hijacking there was because it was so exciting and it was news. He was in the middle of a Mormon neighborhood, and I went up to the door of the house where he lived, and the woman leaned back, she opened the door, saw it was a reporter, and slammed that door in my face. To this day, I can feel the pressure and the noise. They ultimately caught him. He served time. So they caught everybody, except for DB.
And Gabe, there are 1,000 theories about what happened to him. People have come forward claiming to be DB Cooper. They've come forward claiming to know him. In the town of Ariel, which is down near the Oregon border, the general store there has a D.B. Cooper party on the Saturday after Thanksgiving. They've been doing that every year since 1974.
Oh, my gosh. He's like a Billy the Kid folk legend. And it's kind of amazing that we're still talking about this as an unsolved mystery after so many decades. And, I mean, what does the FBI say about this? Are they still even thinking about it, or is it on their docket at all?
They haven't given up, but they're saying that the investigation is what they call open but not active. So we asked for an interview from the FBI's Seattle field office, and they said they don't do interviews on this case anymore because every time they do, they get tips that they have to follow up on, and often they lead nowhere. They sent us a statement which says that they, quote, long ago did all the necessary searches, collected all the evidence that needed to be collected,
and interviewed all the witnesses. That said, when tips come into us, we assess each one and, if credible, pursue the lead accordingly. We found that media coverage generates considerable new interest, which is not proportional to where we are in allocating resources to this investigation.
The only thing that's ever been found is $5,800 of the ransom money on a sandbar along the Columbia River, and that was back in 1980.
You don't have a body, you don't have clothes, you don't have the parachute. This is a big parachute, folks. That's hard to hide. You don't have any eyewitnesses. No one has seen him. So he was I think everybody is really interested in people who get away with it. Dillinger for so long, Willie Sutton, you know, anybody who could escape the law or the system becomes larger than life. And so I also like a mystery.
So wait, Ed, does this mean you don't have the answer? I mean, I was assuming you were coming on to tell us you'd crack the case here.
I wish I was. I don't have the answer. I mean, the only thing we know is that we don't know what happened.
Ah! All right. Well, that was KNKX's Ed Ronco recounting one of the most famous heists ever to take place miles above the Northwest. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And today's theme during our fall fun drive is Money Talks. It's true that money isn't everything or even the most important thing, but sometimes if a relationship or a job goes bad and you need an escape plan, money equals freedom. Seattle writer Paulette Perhatch tells us a story of why it's so important to have that extra escape cash, or as she puts it, an expletive off fund. And a little warning, this story contains some adult content and many bleeps.
You're telling your own story. You graduated college and you're a grown-ass woman now. Tina Fey is your hero, Beyonce your preacher. You know how to take care of you. You've learned self-defense. If any man ever hit you, you'd rip his eyes out. You've seen Mad Men, and if anyone ever sexually harassed you at work, you tell him to f*** right off, throw your coffee in his face, and wave two middle fingers as you marched out the door. You get your first internship. You get your first credit card. You get to walk into Nordstrom, where your mom would never take you, and congratulate yourself with one fabulous black leather skirt and the heels to match. Your car? It's the car of a college student. You get a lease, graduate from the rusted Civic to last year's Accord. You get your first student loan bill. And look at all those numbers. Your life turns into a stock photo tagged Young Professionals. You and your new work friends hang out at the bar across the street from the office. The cocktails cost twice as much as you paid when you still measured time by semesters and nights by cans of PBR. The college boyfriend gets serious. You move into his place, spruce it up by buying your first coffee table together. IKEA lets you put half on your newest credit card. You pay minimum payments, then max out your cards again, buying 2 days' worth of groceries and filling your gas tank halfway. Your bank app upgrades to a new feature that combines all your balances, the shiny Nordstrom card with the Visa and the Chase Freedom you were only supposed to use for emergencies, and tells you that somehow you owe people $7,000. Your boyfriend offers to cover rent for a while. You get a job a few months later, but you're that many loan payments behind. Your first paycheck feels like a breath of air that gets sucked right out of your lungs. Your new boss, who seems nice, calls you in his office, shows you a picture of his kids. He jokes about his son. Then, as you're laughing, he puts his hand on your arm, gives you a little squeeze. You smile it off. You wait to pay the electric bill while you're gathering up the half you owe, and the lights go out. On your phone, in the dark, you see the email about the $50 late fee. Your boyfriend asks how you could be so stupid. I am not stupid, you say. You would never be with anyone who called you names, but you would never be able to make first, last, and deposit right now either. You say yes to P.F. Chang's with your new coworkers because you want to make friends. Your turkey sandwich sounds boring, and what's one more charge? You buy a halter dress you know you can't afford because it makes you look like the successful young woman you want everyone to think you are. Your boss tells you that you look nice in that dress, asks you to do a spin. Just to get the moment over with, you do. Your boyfriend asks how much you paid for it, says it makes you look chubby. You lock yourself in the bathroom until he bangs on the door so hard you think he must have hurt himself. After he falls asleep, you search Craigslist for places and can't believe how expensive rent's gotten around town. You erase your internet history and go to sleep. A few weeks later, your boss calls a one-on-one in his office, walks in behind you, and stands too close. His breath fogs your neck. His hand crawls up your new dress. You squirm away. He says, "Sorry, I thought..." You know what to do. You're just shocked to find you're not doing it. You are not telling him to f*** off. You are not storming out. All you're doing is math. You have $159 in the bank, and your car payment and your maxed out credit cards, and you'll die before you ask your dad for a loan again, and it all equals one thought. I need this job. "It's okay," you hear your voice saying. "Just forget it." You scurry out of the room, survey the office half full of women, and wonder how many of them have secrets like the one you're about to keep. At the apartment, your best guy friend calls. After you hang up, your boyfriend says you laugh too much with him, that you're flirting with him, probably sleeping with him. You say it's not like that. He yells, you yell, you try to leave, he blocks your way. When you struggle to get by, he grabs your wrist in the exact way they pretended to in self-defense class, and you know to go for the eyes, but you don't know how to go for his eyes. He yanks you back until you fall and crack the coffee table. He seems so sorry, cries even, so that night you lie down in the same bed. You stare up at the dark and try to calculate how long it would take you to save up the cash to move out. Telling yourself that he's sorry, convincing yourself it was an accident, discounting this one time because he didn't hit you exactly, seems much more feasible than finding the money with what you owe every month. The next time you go out as a couple, his arm around your shoulders, you look at all the other girlfriends and imagine finger-sized bruises under their long sleeves. Wait, this story sucks. If it were one of those choose-your-own-adventures, here's where you'd want to flip back, start over, rewrite what happens to you. You graduated college and you're a grown-ass woman now. Tina Fey is your hero, Beyonce your preacher. If any man ever hit you, if anyone ever sexually harassed you, you'd tell him to f*** right off. You want to be, no, you will be the kind of woman who can tell anyone to f*** off if a f*** off is deserved. So naturally, you start a f*** off fund. To build this account, you keep living like you lived as a broke student. Drive the decade-old Civic even after the fender falls off. Buy the thrift store clothes. You waitress on Saturdays, even though you work Monday through Friday. You make do with the garage sale coffee table. It's hard, your loan payments suck, but you make girls' night an at-home thing and do tacos potluck. You save up a f*** off fund of $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, then enough to live half a year without anyone else's help. So when your boss tells you that you look nice, asks you to do a spin, you say, "Is there some way you need my assistance in the professional capacity, or can I go back to my desk now?" When your boyfriend calls you stupid, you say that if he ever says that again, you're out of there, and it's not hard to imagine how you'll accomplish your getaway. When your boss attempts to grope you, you say, "F*** off, you creep." You wave two middle fingers in the air and march over to HR. Whether the system protects you or fails you, you will be able to take care of yourself. When your boyfriend pounds the door, grabs your wrist, you see it as the red flag it is. Leave a post-it note in the night that says, "F*** off, lunatic douche." You stay up in a fancy hotel drinking room service champagne, shopping for apartments, and swiping around on Tinder. Once your f*** off fund is built back up with your new, better job, you pay cash for the most badass black leather skirt you can find, upgrade to the used but nicer convertible you've always wanted, and start saving to go to Thailand with your best friend next summer. Yes, that is a better story. It's a story no one ever told me. It's the kind I'd hope for you.
Paulette Perhatch is a writer in Seattle. It's Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is our fall fun drive show, where our theme is Money Talks. With this next story, we are going to rewind the tape a little bit to a hairier, free, lovier time here in the Northwest. And leading us on that journey is my colleague, Nick Morrison. We've heard some tales of Nick's past lives here, including his years in radio, his time running a strip club slash daycare, even his stint as an indie rock financier. Then there was the time when Nick got involved in the family business, which was not something he was expecting.
My father really struck it big in business after I had grown up and left the house. He got into a three-man corporation that grew potatoes and then were their own middleman. He's raised and shipped tubers to the far corners of the earth.
So you're a young adult at this time. What era are we talking about here? What years?
This would be 1967, 1968. I came back to Eastern Washington from the Bay Area to see my mother, who had had a small heart attack. So I hitchhiked into Othello from San Francisco, went to my parents' house, put my duffel bag down, and began to walk across town to the hospital to visit my mother. And I had a ponytail, and I had bell bottoms, and I had a velour pullover. And people were pulling over, literally, to the side of the road as I walked down Main Street to look at me. They had seen these pictures in Life magazine, but they hadn't seen them in life. So I'm back in Eastern Washington. I'm going to move to Seattle, but I have no money. And though my father and I never really knew each other throughout my entire childhood, he felt it incumbent upon him to give me a job.
What was your dad like? What kind of a guy was he?
My father was a very upright fella. He was very well respected. He was a very honest man. He was a decorated Marine from World War II, very proud of his service, but not the great Santinian anyway. But as I said, we didn't really know each other. We were two different guys in two different worlds.
And did he have any preconceived ideas about the kind of culture that you were into, about hippies and long hairs and stuff?
It mildly disgusted him. You know, when I showed up and we met eye to eye, you know, I think he probably said, Jesus.
Did you get the sense that he respected you?
Not at that time. Uh-uh. But my job in the family business was to stand around with a hand truck, right? And there was a machine that would take potatoes, drop them into 10-pound bags, cinch the bags, drop them on a conveyor belt. They'd go to the end of the conveyor belt, and people would put 5 10-pound bags into a box, seal the box, put the box on the hand truck, and do that 5 times until your hand truck was full, and then you'd push it out to a box car or a semi-truck. So I spent all day looking at this machinery working. And one day it dawned on me that if they rejiggered it just a little bit, there was a good possibility that more potatoes would come out faster with fewer people.
What was your motivation in making this improvement? Was it because you deeply cared about the efficiency of the business?
No, there were some guys who had been around the warehouse business longer, and they got to just count things as they went by, not push them.
And so they're using their eyes rather than their shoulders.
Yeah. So I went to my dad and I said, hey, I've got this idea. If I can make this machine more efficient with fewer people, can I have a counting job? And he said, you'll have to talk to Jacobson. He's your foreman. So I went to Jacobson. Jacobson thought he'd give it a try, and it worked. And a light went on in my dad's head. I didn't realize that the light had come on for maybe about a week. And then all of a sudden, there's this other long-haired guy popped up out of nowhere. He's working there, and he, too, stands out because of his appearance. So we gravitated toward each other on a break, and he said, you're the boss's kid? I said, yeah, for all the good it does me. And he said, that guy scared the hell out of me this morning. He said, I was coming through town looking for work. I stopped on that side street by the tavern, went in the tavern, asked around, didn't get very much information, got drunk, went back out, and slept in my car, which is where I sleep most nights. And he said, this morning I woke up and somebody was pounding on my window. And it was this guy who I thought was going to want to beat me. So I just rolled my window down a crack. It was your old man. And he said, hey, you want a job? What happened was he saw me, kind of the worthless son, get an idea that helped his business. And he thought, there are lots of people floating around this country just like my boy, and they're not getting put to work because people don't like the way they look. I'm going to start hiring them. And this could work out well. So by the end of the season, he had a lot of hippies, including a Rhodes Scholar. People were always coming through town looking for harvest work. And he just started picking off the long hairs.
Did you know that he was capable of making that kind of a shift?
I did not. And it was the beginning of a long and lovely friendship.
Really?
Yes.
So, come on. You're telling me that this actually opened up the father-son relationship too?
It was definitely the door.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I never took the time to get to know the guy, right? Until he started hiring people that looked like me, and then I thought he might be okay.
Maybe this guy's all right.
Yeah.
He had the same thought about you, I guess.
I think he did, yeah.
Did this kind of open-mindedness or openness to people that didn't look like the people he was used to being around, did that persist, do you think, or was that a passing thing?
No, it persisted and succeeded wildly. The next couple of years was kind of a downturn in the potato biz, and my father and his little corporation, the family business, kept having successful year after year after year.
And the secret?
Hippies.
Nick Morrison is our production manager and spud wrangler here. Thank you, Nick, for sharing your tale of joining the family business.
Well, thank you for asking.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme for Pledge Drive Time is Money Talks. When Marcellus Owens of Seattle was 8 years old, his mother Tiffany died. This was back in 2007. Before that, Tiffany had been supporting three children on her paycheck from Jack in the Box. And for a family that at times was homeless, spending some nights riding buses to stay warm and dry, this was a stretch of stability. A roof over their heads, regular meals, beds to sleep in. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing has the story of how it all fell apart when Tiffany was diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension.
This is when your lungs have high blood pressure. And people can live a long time with this condition if they get the right care. But when it's not treated, it's the heart that usually gives out. Tiffany started missing too much time at work.
She missed so much work that she lost her job. And along with her job, she lost her health care.
That's Marcellus when he was 11. In his mother's final months, she was an activist for healthcare reform. And once she was gone, Marcellus took on her role. He became a poster child for the movement as President Obama pushed for the passage of the Affordable Care Act. This chubby-faced African-American boy with a short afro told his mother's story to hundreds of people at rallies. He did the cable news shows.
Marcellus, tell us a little bit about what's the message that you're telling the members of Congress?
I'm telling the members of Congress that the health care bill should be passed because everybody deserves health care.
Lawmakers like Senator Patty Murray were telling his story.
I met him at a health care rally in Seattle. He was 10 years old. And he is
And the day President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, Marcellus was there. In the White House, Vice President Joe Biden stood behind Marcellus, gripping the boy squarely on the shoulders with both hands the way a father would. Marcellus took a red eye with his grandmother to be there in time for the signing, and they forgot to bring appropriate clothes. So White House staff rushed out and bought him a dark suit and a blue tie that happened to match what President Obama was wearing.
I heard the story of 11-year-old Marcellus Owens, who's right here, looking sharp. He and I made sure to coordinate our ties today. Yeah, it looks good.
Marcellus became known as the Obamacare kid. Newspapers and cable news shows call him every year leading up to March 23rd, the anniversary of the law. And for a child, he's been doing a very grown-up thing, talking about the importance of health insurance. Every year, he's asked the same questions. Tell us your story, the story of your mom, Marcellus. What was it like to be there when history was made?
With all of the check-ins with media, I don't know, I felt kind of trapped by like the Obamacare kid thing. When they were asking me like how I was doing and stuff like that, I had to like kind of say like, you know, I'm doing fine, you know, school's good. I think they had sort of an idea of who I was. I sort of felt like I couldn't be who I was. I felt like I had to sort of keep that image of the Obamacare kid thing, and I sort of let that take over.
Last spring, the requests for interviews started to come in again. CNN reporter John Blake called Marcellus.
It was just going to be a regular check-in.
As they were finishing up the conversation, John Blake asked Marcellus if he had anything else to share. Marcellus paused for a moment and said, yeah. But before Marcellus answered that question, he checked in with his grandmother, Gina Owens, to see if it was okay to share something really personal with this global news outlet. Gina nodded, yes. So Marcellus got back on the phone and told Blake that he isn't Marcellus anymore. His name is now Marcy. She identifies as a young woman. It's a feeling that she's had since she was 6 years old.
You know when you say you're lifting a burden off your shoulder? I could literally feel like that phone got so much lighter and just everything just... I think the sun came out when... I feel like the sun came out. I'm not sure if I'm remembering that right, but I feel like the room got brighter and I just got lighter and I just felt like, you know, the winds of time were turning for me and something good was happening. But yeah, I just felt good that day.
Marcy is now 17. She lives with her grandmother, Gina, and her two sisters. Marcy told her grandmother about her transition well before the phone call with CNN. Gina is still getting used to having three granddaughters instead of two.
I'm mourning the loss of Marcellus, the little boy, but I've gained a new granddaughter. So it's kind of an equal balance there, you know. But I am mourning. I miss that little boy, you know.
You lost a name, not a person.
But I've gained a new name. I look at the old name being put aside and the new name taking over. It's like me with my last name. My last name is Owens, but it wasn't always Owens. My surname is Del Fiore. And I think that name change came when I became an adult and got married. And so even though Marcy says that little boy is still here, she's living this new life now. Growing into the adult that she's becoming is not Marcellus. It's Marcy. And I don't know, I think that in some way you probably don't understand what I'm saying, Marcy. But it is happening. And you'll probably realize it more as you grow.
As much as Marcy wants to move on with her new life and away from being the Obamacare kid, she's grateful for the experiences that moniker has provided. When President Obama heard about Marcy's news, he invited her to a pride event at the White House. Health insurance wasn't on the agenda. While she and Obama did not coordinate their outfits this time, no matching ties, Marcy wore a dress, makeup, and a wig. One thing is similar in the photo of them together. They both have enormous smiles.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. And a quick update on Marcy. She's reportedly doing great and enrolled in Shoreline Community College. That's it for the show this week, but just one last reminder that the only way Sound Effects stays on the air is through your support. I'm about to read the credits, which is an excellent time to mosey on over to knkx.org and make a donation. I bet you can finish by the time I'm done. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. We got help this week from Ed Ronco, Arwen Nix, Warren Langford, and Nick Morrison. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. After you donate to KNKX, take a second to subscribe to our now twice-weekly podcast. You can find that on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your audio. And that includes your smart speaker. Just say, play Sound Effect, the podcast. You can also find us on Facebook or send email to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when our theme is Blood Ties. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.